Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 118, recorded September 4th, 2013. Tim Jennison. Triangulation is brought to you by Shutterstock.com with over 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips. Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code Triangulation in the number 9. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get some of the smartest, most interesting people online in here and talk to them and ask them questions and learn a lot. And I'm so glad you're here for today's Triangulation because we have a living legend in studio with us. His name is Tim Jennison. And I think more than anybody, he makes what we do or made what we do possible. The father, really, I think a lot of people say, of desktop video. Tim, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you for joining
us.
Thanks
for having me.
Founder of New Tech, which we, of course, have been using since day one. I decided when I was looking for a switcher what to use, I said, this is it. This is the one. And we've grown with your products as they've gotten more and more powerful.
Well, you're the kind of person we kind of had in mind, you know. Broadcast television is inaccessible, and we wanted to democratize video.
It gives us the capability of doing effectively broadcast-like television for a fraction of the cost. But let me go. I want to start at the beginning. We were talking before the show. You grew up in Iowa. Your dad was an engineer, mechanical, civil engineer?
Electrical and mechanical, yeah. And he always had a bench in the basement with all the tubes, and I was getting shocks and, you know, crawling up in his bench when he wasn't there. But I sort of learned electronics from him by osmosis, almost. I remember sitting on his knee when I was probably 5 years old, and he had the ohm meter, and he'd say, okay, Ohm's law is I equals E over R. And you know, it's beyond me, but
what is,
you know,
I don't even know what I and E are, let alone R.
So, but years later, it sort of rung a bell.
It was in your head. It was built in.
Yeah, and he just, you know, like a lot of people, technical people, they just assume you understand everything
you know
what you're
he
saying.
Is. Yeah,
and he did. So, and but I learned electronics with vacuum tubes, and later in life, I had to relearn everything, you know, with solid state.
Do you remember building? Did you do kits as a kid?
No, kits. No,
you didn't even do kits. You did it from scratch.
Right. Yeah. So breadboarding. You'd take a piece of wood, and you'd pound in nails and connect wires.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. And Dad had the resistors and the capacitors and the diodes and everything.
Junk box.
Do you remember the first projects you did? I mean, what they were?
Yeah,
were they radios?
Yeah, one of my first ones was a 40-meter ham transmitter, a single tube.
I'm thinking crystal radio. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I had a crystal radio.
You
yeah.
built a 40-meter ham transmitter.
But I lived in the country and, you know, far away from other people. And these tubes and transistors were my best friends.
They brought the world
in. Yeah.
As a kid, I wasn't that sophisticated, but I remember listening to shortwave radio and just being blown away that you could, and you could hear people in Russian, and it was so cool. So did you get a ham license at that time? Or?
I was a ham operator.
Unlicensed,
now,
it sounds
did I have
like.
A license? That's another question.
I've heard people say it that way before. Yeah, I know what that
means. Yeah, but
means.
Sure. Yeah, it just seemed like such a hassle to go through, you know, to fill out the paperwork and stuff. But I did learn Morse code. I
did you?
Operate it a lot. And
you have a license now.
I have a license now, yes.
Yeah. What's your call sign?
Alpha Foxtrot 5 Golf Golf, AF5GG.
And where do you live on the ham bands?
I hang around 40 meters mostly. And,
still?
And 20 meters, yeah. 40 meters is my favorite.
You fell in love with 40.
Well, there's a group of guys on 40 meters. Man, we're nerding out on ham radio here.
That's okay. That's what we do here.
There's a group of guys that are into high-quality audio.
Ah.
And I'm one of them. And we just like to sound as good as you can sound on ham radio. And not everybody likes that sort of thing because we use a little more bandwidth on the band.
Right.
You know, we'll use 6 kilohertz instead of 2.8 kilohertz.
Yeah.
And sometimes people complain, then we just turn it down and say, okay,
it's an awful fat signal the guy's sending. And this, you're doing it at San Antonio now. You've moved down with...
Yeah, live in San Antonio.
With New Tech. So that's cool. So you built radios as a kid. When did it go digital for you?
Seventh grade science fair project. I built a rudimentary computer that could add in base 10, and it could multiply.
That's pretty sophisticated.
10. Yeah. And this was at the time when integrated circuits, the very first integrated circuits, were starting to show up in, you know, logic gates.
Right. Do you remember what you used?
It was a UL914. Was one of the gates. Oh, man, I could think of the names of those chips.
It's so cool that you could. It's funny how you do. It kind of implants itself in your mind.
Yeah.
And so at that point, personal computing was a pipe dream still. I mean, it was just the beginning of ICs.
Even science fiction, you know, as a kid, you're reading science fiction. Nobody was writing science fiction stories about having a computer
they were big
in your pocket.
Room-sized things.
It was
HAL 9000s.
Once in a while, there'd be a sci-fi story about he pulled a calculator out of his pocket and multiplied.
They'll never be that small.
Exactly. But nobody saw the computers coming. You know,
yeah.
There was always going to be a brain inside a mountain somewhere.
Do you remember your first personal computer?
Oh, yeah. I built it. It was a 6800 Motorola.
Not a kit, not an MSI or something like that. You built it from scratch.
Yep.
Because they were all using Zilog chips. And
they were expensive. I, you know, frankly couldn't afford the kits. But it was so exciting back then. I mean,
so neat.
That was like, wow, I have a computer. And, you know, then you had to figure out something to do with it. So,
right.
That was the hard part. And we had to set all these switches, and it just took
You didn't
hours.
Have a teletype interface.
Not,
you had
not,
to, you
not
had
right
to flip
away.
Front.
Right.
The front
switches. But then, I went through the teletype phase. I have a pretty cool collection of old teletypes, some very rare ones.
Did you see our old model out in the lobby? Yeah.
I have a Model 12.
Oh.
A Model 12.
You got me beat.
Yeah, Model 12. It's the first unit made by the Teletype Corporation.
That thing looks like it's steam-powered. That thing is so big.
Have you fired it up? Does it
No,
run?
I don't even know if it works.
I'll get it running for you.
Really?
Yeah, they almost always work. Just a little...
You couldn't break them?
A little oil. No, they're absolutely...
There's big, heavy metal gears and...
Yeah.
Wow, that's really... What did you major in college? I mean, what was your interest? Was it electronics then, or
rock and roll,
sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
Pinball.
Yeah.
Pinball.
There's a nexus between engineering minds and pinball. I don't know what it is.
There absolutely is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in my case, it was a game called Jack in the Box by Gottlieb. We called it Cram the Clowns. There were 10. drop targets across the top, each with a clown face, and you have to get them all down. Yep. And that's where all my quarters and spare time went. And so
sounds like a wasted youth. I hate to tell you, Tim.
Well, yeah, I left college shortly thereafter.
Yes.
And I really consider it to be, you know, like a four-year head start on my peers. The fact that I got the heck out of college when I did.
All the great founders, I'm not going to say this, kids, be cool, stay in school, but I have to point out a lot of these great founders, myself included.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's maybe not such a good idea to go to school. I mean, you end up deeply in debt.
Yep.
Unless you have a rich uncle.
Yep.
And, you know, I was able to educate myself, and I was, had I studied what I wanted to learn, they didn't know about microprocessors. That, you know, you couldn't take a good course on, mm-hmm. you know, you could study Fortran, I guess, and you could run punch cards, but they didn't know anything about what I wanted to study. And so after I was out of college, I just read books. And I would hang out at engineering libraries wherever I was, whatever city I was in, and I just, you know, made my own courseware.
So you did, but you taught yourself, basically.
I have a homemade engineering degree.
And was the Amiga your first, like, packaged computer?
No. I was into the Tandy computers at first, and I developed some products for the Tandys.
You know, if Burke or somebody would get, I have an old Tandy that somebody sent me in my room, in my office, I just got. Maybe I could show this to you. You could tell me what the heck it is. It's in the box in the back of the room there. People, you know, send us their old stuff. You see, we've got a Commodore up there, a 128 PET.
Yes.
We've got an Osborne over here.
I saw that.
We've got one of the Amigas. Carson, are you getting for me? It's in the back there in the box. I just want to show this to you. So Tandy was your first TRS-80s, that kind of thing?
TRS-80 color computer.
Coco.
Yeah.
We got a Coco. We had a Coco. I think it's in the basement now. It's running a... Was running a program.
Well, my first product, commercial product, was a audio mix down system for control studio, for control rooms in audio.
People weren't doing this at the time. They weren't using computers for this stuff.
The big guys were. Warner Brothers had automated consoles. You know, you
got the
multi-track
faders,
and the faders. So I made one based on a personal computer, and I thought this was going to be a huge seller. And it wasn't, because it turns out what you really need is talent. You don't need the automated faders.
Carsten, come on, just bring it over here. You don't have to. I don't even know what this is. Somebody just sent me this. This is wild.
Oh, that's a 100.
Is it a Model 100?
I believe so.
Or something.
Oh, no, that's not.
This is the 200 portable computer.
Yes, that's
so the, for the young people in the audience, this was the height. This might have been the first laptop.
A lot of journalists used those.
I remember the Model 100s,
they could send their stories in over the phone line.
You'd plug it into the phone line.
Exactly.
Have a 300 baud modem. Anyway, thank you for whoever sent that to me. This was a business for you already.
Yeah, I wrote a paint program for the Coco, for the color computer, called Cocomax.
Cocomax. Mm-hmm. I'm sure people remember that. So this is really, I think I did this too. This was a way of taking something you loved and make a hobby and trying to make it so you could afford to buy the stuff and continue to do
it. Well, my wife was just overjoyed when that first check arrived. Because up to that point, she had to put up with the noisy teletype in the kitchen. Yeah, it was in the kitchen, and it would wake up the babies, and then checks started arriving, and that was huge.
Awesome.
That was huge.
You can make a living at this.
And then what she did was she took some of that money and bought me an Epson RX-80 printer so that the teletype could go away. Yeah.
The first early dot matrix printers. Those were great, though.
They were noisy, too, though.
But they weren't as noisy.
Not as noisy. They would shake the whole house, the teletype.
Yeah, it was thunder.
Yeah.
Oh, how cool. So you were interested both in hardware and software. Yeah. You were writing code as well.
Yeah.
Did that come naturally to you?
Yes.
You liked it? Basic at first?
Fortran was the first thing I learned in seventh grade.
Oh,
my cousin taught it to me. And but then once I had my first computer built, everything was machine language, not even assembly language, machine language, which is related, but it's just like ones and zeros.
Well, this is where you had an advantage, because the 6800, unlike the Z80 and then the 8086, had a much more elegant assembly.
It was like a textbook.
It was beautiful.
Computer architecture.
Much better than the 6502, which everybody else was learning on the Apple side.
The only book I found in the Iowa State University Library about computers that made any sense at all was a book called Computer Architecture by Caxton Foster. And in this book, he described an elementary computer, a computer that was powerful enough to solve all problems, but the simplest possible. And he described this thing. He says it had two accumulators, and he described it. And later, when I was looking for a chip to build a computer, I realized that the 6800 was almost exactly like classic computer that was described in the book. So I knew what to do with it.
Yeah. So when the Amiga came along, you felt right at home. That's 68,000 based.
Yeah, and the reason I was attracted to the Amiga is that I was a video guy.
Oh, so video came before the Amiga.
Yeah, as a kid, I was into filmmaking, made 8mm movies.
That's interesting. We're going to get to the fact that you have a new movie, which just showed at the Telluride Film Festival, that is all the rage. So you ended up going full cycle and making movies now.
Yeah. I was a frustrated filmmaker. 8mm was not a good format, and you had to cut and splice.
Oh, horrible.
And then when video came out, you really couldn't edit that. You could try to cut and splice it, but it's worthless. And that's kind of why NewTek started.
You could press pause.
Yeah. Pause control editing. Exactly.
That was it. In fact, a lot of newsrooms were doing A-B editing kind of like that. Slam a tape in, slam a tape in, slam a tape in, play a little of that, play a little of that, play a little of that. Mm-hmm. Crazy. So you said computers are the perfect tool for this.
Yeah, I go computers, video. These
it's got to be a better way.
Belong together.
And I got to emphasize how early this is. We're in VCR territory. This is analog video sources.
Right. And the computers were just not fast enough to deal with video. I mean, they could just barely get some characters on the screen. That's it. They could not display. I mean, this is the time of. The IBM PC had 16 colors, if you include two shades of black. And the Macintosh was black and white.
Black and white.
And you had to have a special screwdriver to open it up. And the Amiga came along, and this was like a mind blower to me because it could display high quality color imagery, but more important, because of its ancestry in video games, they made it compatible with standard video frequencies, NTSC video, so you could gen lock it. And
it's hugely important to be able to gen lock.
Yeah, because you could then feed a camera into it and do interesting things to video. And that's when the idea. I read the, I think it was the 1985 August. I think it was 1985 issue of Byte magazine. It was the special on the Amiga computer.
I remember that cover.
Yeah,
vividly.
Yeah, and I'm reading through there, and they go NTSC frequencies, gen lock. I go, okay, this is
and
this is it.
4,096 colors.
Yes.
Don't forget.
Exactly.
And that bouncing ball.
Yeah, and I was just in love. And I ordered the first one. I went right down to the Commodore dealer, and I said, I want the first one that comes in, and got right to work.
What was the first thing? It wasn't Video Toaster.
No, we did a thing called DigiView, which was a video capture device.
Yeah. Okay.
And you plugged the camera into it. It was a little white box that went on the back of the computer. And video digitizers were, you know, there were a few of them around for like an Apple II. But this is one that could actually do 4,096 colors and sold very well. And it was sort of the venture capital to start up the video.
That bootstrapped the next thing. It's so funny because 1985, in many respects, doesn't seem very long ago at all, at least to me, probably to you. We were just watching The Breakfast Club, 1985. I mean, that seems like a relatively recent movie to me. And yet, in terms of digital technology, this was the Stone Age. And I don't know if people understand how hard it was to do what you were doing. I mean, you were really pushing the limits. I remember Dvorak getting a Video Toaster and going crazy. I think he was half in love with Kiki, but I think the other thing was he was editing, you know, Bill Gates keynotes and taking all the burps and the ums and putting them all together. And I was blown away that he could do this. Alex Bennett, who was a radio personality here, and he was doing his own TV show out of his kitchen with a Video Toaster. This was a revolution.
Yeah, thousands of people suddenly could make video. And,
huge.
You know, there were people doing video with, like two tape decks. All you could do is cuts. You couldn't add titles. You couldn't have any sort of transitions. And you couldn't look like a real TV station.
Mm-mm.
But once the toaster was out there, you could get that look.
How hard was that to make that work?
Oh,
I feel like there must have been some long nights.
Nowadays, with our current products, the TriCasters and 3Play, we are routing all these high-def streams through the computer's memory and processing everything in real time. And it's one of the hardest things you can do with a computer, really. And
because it's so much data.
Well, and if you drop a frame, it's the end of the world.
Right, it has to be real time. Yeah.
But back then, so the computers we have now are gigahertz computers, and we have gigabytes of RAM and so on and so forth. The Amiga ran at 8 megahertz. Megahertz. So there is no way you're going to get a video signal through that computer. It's just not going to happen. So our card that installed inside there had its own high-speed stuff that then was controlled by the Amiga. And that was the secret sauce.
So the throughput, and was it analog or was it digital?
It was both analog and digital.
It was both.
There was an analog section and a digital section. So the analog section did the fades and some of the what we called organic wipes, where there would be clouds, you know, revealing one picture over another. And then there was a digital section that would do pushes and digital video effects. So it was a hybrid between the two.
Anybody who saw the TV show Home Improvement saw remember how they would do those wacky transitions out of every segment? That was a toaster.
I think so.
They were using a video toaster. It was a mind-boggling thing at that time. And again, it doesn't seem like so long ago, but nobody could. Personal computing wasn't anywhere near powerful enough to do what you were doing. You were doing magic.
No, but we could see Moore's Law was going to solve the problem eventually.
You knew it would improve.
You had to just extrapolate that line, and at some point, you know, we started to work on the TriCaster family of products, and we go, well, in 2 or 3 years, Pentium chips are going to be up to 75 megahertz. Oh, how could that possibly be? No, that's what the curve says.
Oh, they're gonna.
And, you know.
I remember in 92, the first P90 I saw, we was like, this is so fast. You can't believe how fast this is. And
then, but we knew at some point you could actually process the video through the computer.
You knew it was coming. Yep. But no, I mean, really, seriously, you were doing stuff that nobody was even dreaming of. And it really seemed like a black magic at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was partly because you had Amigas, which were quite advanced. They were multitasking. Mm-hmm. I mean,
the operating system was perfect. The task switching in the multitasking of the Amiga was triggered by the top of a video frame, which was absolutely perfect for what we needed to do. It just couldn't ask for better.
What was Hollywood and the television community's response to the toaster? Did they laugh at it, say, "Oh, that's an amateur product. Yeah. We're professionals," or did they adopt? Did they like it?
Well.
Because they're spending millions of dollars.
There was a famous, there was a post house called the Post Group, and they were sort of the pinnacle of post production in Hollywood.
Right.
And I think they're still around in some form. I was talking to a guy from the Post Group at an NAB show, and he came up and introduced himself, and he said he was from the Post Group. And I said, "So, you think you'll ever get a video toaster?" And he says, "Oh, I've got three of them." I said, "That is surprising to me that you would have three of them. I thought there would be a little garage across the street called the Toast Group with the toasters."
And we don't know those guys.
He said, you got to understand, if the customer comes in and asks for something, I have to have it. I don't show it to them unless I'm prompted. I wish to heck you had never made the thing, but I have them. And that was kind of the attitude. You know, they would use it to for very cost-critical jobs where they couldn't, get into the big rooms and have a lot of people.
I think it was it Babylon 5?
Babylon 5 was one of the big ones, yeah.
Because this was a very polished, slick sci-fi show that was very cheap. And they were able to do computer graphics for television in ways that people didn't just, it would have been, impossible.
Absolutely.
Before. Were they using Lightwave? What were they?
They were using Lightwave on Amigas. Yeah, and
that was also your software product. Yeah.
Yep. Lightwave was part of the toaster. It came with it. It was just free.
Right.
And there were several basic pieces of the toaster, and one of the little buttons there said 3D. And if you pushed it, it opened up this, top, front, and side view, and you could make your objects. And most people were just scared to death because it reminded them of homework. But
you still do Lightwave, right?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And
it still comes with the TriCaster, doesn't it?
Does not.
Oh, it doesn't. Okay.
No, but a lot of people use it, and
you can integrate it in. Yes. I remember there.
Yeah,
was
you can
a
make
button.
Virtual sets.
You still had that
3D
button that would. Yeah.
But Ron Thornton, who is this genius 3D guy, he did the effects for Doctor Who.
Oh wow!
Made aliens out of vacuum cleaners and stuff, and he pitched us on. Supporting them in their effort to make Babylon 5. So I had to go meet with the producer of the show, a guy named Doug Netter. And he's a cigar-chomping, classic Hollywood executive. And Ronnie tells me here you guys can help us make this show cheap. Yeah. And we just want to know you're going to support us. Absolutely, we'll support you. And that's the worst thing I had ever said. Because,
was it really horrible?
It was horrible. But it made Lightwave much, much better because, for example, Ron sent us a frame on a floppy drive. We put the floppy drive in the computer, and there's this gorgeous spaceship on the screen, and we just can't believe what we're looking at. He had made this. It was the Babylon 5 ship in Lightwave. Well, a few weeks later, he called up, and he said, "Guys, I'm dead. The ship looks great until it starts moving. When it starts moving, all the little lights in the portholes start to scintillate." And we go, "Oh, yeah, what you're getting there is aliasing." And he says, I can't have aliasing.
No aliasing.
So we had to fix the aliasing.
Oh, my God.
One thing after another. It was. But that's what it took. And so customers like that, and Todd Rundgren was another one.
He would
just send us these long faxes, would come out of the fax machine. I got to have this. I got to have that. This isn't working right.
Both a challenge, but at the same time, and I think the reputation you gained from Babylon 5, I mean, everybody knew they're doing this so inexpensively.
Yeah, it changed the economies of CGI.
It absolutely did. Yeah. It absolutely did. Mm-hmm. Can you see? Here's a little bit of a Babylon. All of this done in Lightwave. No scintillation. No aliasing.
No, the aliasing was gone at this point. And what a great show, because it, you know, the plot stretched across the entire series.
Yeah.
It was unprecedented.
Yeah, and they what they were able to do, and it's the first time this was, you know, done in a commercial, inexpensive television series, was really quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. Quite remarkable. So were they using toasters as well? What were they doing?
Generally speaking, they were just using Lightwave.
Just designing
but,
stuff on Lightwave.
You know, they would... there would be a toaster in the machine that would let them visualize
Got
the NTSC
it.
Output.
So they could see early renders,
yeah.
And then they render it out. And,
right. Yeah. And then later on, we separated Lightwave from the toaster,
right.
And then
they didn't need to
use it without
yeah.
that.
So when was the transition to TriCaster, and how did that happen?
Well, you know, Commodore encountered some difficulties. You know, we were number one with a bullet.
Named Jack Tramiel, yes.
we were selling video toasters like there was no tomorrow,
yeah.
And then suddenly there was no tomorrow. They went bankrupt.
Right.
And it's just the worst possible thing that can happen to a company. We had...
Because you really were tied to that platform.
Yeah, we had written code that was, you know, diddling bits right down into their little custom Gosh. Chips. It was not portable. However... Lightwave was written in C. And at that time, very fortunately for us, Microsoft came out with Win32, which let us compile for the first time 32-bit C code on a PC.
You needed 32 bits because you had massive data sets. And
yeah, the whole thing
needed,
a lot needed of 32 bits. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we could then start selling Lightwave. And for a while, we became the Lightwave
company. So you just
ported
it to Windows, that's
mm-hmm.
all?
Yep, and we also ported it to the Mac, and we ported it to Linux, and we ported it to the DEC Alpha. We had a lot of versions.
Isn't C great?
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, that's kind of amazing that you could actually do that.
And then we sort of reset, and we said, we want to make a new toaster-like product, but, you know...
On modern hardware.
On modern hardware, yeah.
And the lesson learned from the Amiga, you probably didn't want to tie it too tightly to the... To the hardware base.
No, not a particular brand, certainly. But we realized that the IBM PC
that
was going to be the best
yeah.
Platform because Apple was still kind of a closed system.
Right.
And we really would have liked to use the
it
Apple.
It had that
because,
nice 68,000 yeah, in there.
It was much more similar to the Amiga, but
yeah.
No, we couldn't do it.
Why not? We needed something that was more open. What was the difference between what Apple was doing at that time and Microsoft?
Well,
you didn't want to be on one hardware platform?
It looked to us like Apple was going to move slower in
right.
in increasing the speed.
Right. Yep.
And there was just this insane development, high-speed development going on in the PC. They changed every month. They got
right.
better. And the graphics cards.
Right. It's analogous to what's going on now with mobile, where yes. Android is churning, and Apple's just kind of steadily... Yep.
And
also, you probably didn't want to be tied to one company as you were with Commodore.
Yes.
For that.
Once burned, twice shy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Apple was also, you know, looking kind of
at those days,
shaky.
This is mid-90s, not the best place
right.
to be.
So we were able to, you know, Moore's Law is still going on, and we're also taking advantage of the huge changes in gaming
mm-hmm.
and the GPUs.
Did you use DirectX, OpenGL, any of that stuff?
All of the above.
All yeah. of the above.
Mm-hmm. At different times, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, today, I mean, the graphics cards are just, you know, it's staggering the amount of processing that's going on in those things.
So in the early days, did you bypass the GPUs and just was all CPU-based?
In the early days, it was mostly CPU.
And you'd maybe make some... there was additional hardware, right? You had to put some cards in there?
Yeah, the card was to do the I.O.
Because it's not fast enough to take all that data.
Unlike the old video toaster that had a lot of video... chips on it and a lot of processing, all we had to do was get the video signal into computer memory and then back out of computer memory after we were done processing.
Using DMA, just so
yep.
you're blasting it in.
And
there.
That's all that card did. And,
yeah.
And basically today's cards do the same thing.
Right.
In essence.
Right.
We do everything in software.
How interesting. And yet the capabilities now are amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm shocked. It's great living in the future.
We're going to see something. I guess we have something new to announce in a little bit. Let me take a break. I want to come back and talk to you about movies
okay.
and about your movie, about Vermeer.
All right.
Because I think that's kind of... Was this all along the same time you're doing the engineering and the software?
Yeah, I've been working on it for
you never lost
four
that,
or 5 years.
Never lost that dream to do a movie?
No. That's I was neat. A frustrated filmmaker, and now I'm a fulfilled filmmaker.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in a second.
Okay.
We're talking, this is a lot of fun. I hope you're enjoying it. We're talking to literally a living legend, the guy who really made it possible to do what we do, Tim Jennison, the founder of New Tech, founder of the Video Toaster, creator of the Video Toaster, and also a filmmaker. And there's been a lot of talk about Oscar just in the last couple of days. We're getting the exclusive on this one. Our show today brought to you by Shutterstock.com. 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, video clips. You know, you can get Babylon 5. Forget it. You can get beautiful illustrations, graphics, vectors for your blog, for your publication, for your menu, for your website, for your Facebook landing page at Shutterstock.com. Start by just creating a free account. You don't even need to give them a credit card number, just so you can play with it. The search engine is so cool. You can search not only with nouns, you know, TVs, but you can search with adjectives. Happy TVs, blue TVs, Christmas TVs. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professionals, artists, photographers. They do great videos. Shutterstock has 28 million images right now, and they are adding more than 10,000 images every day. So there's always something new. They sell image packs and monthly subscriptions. But like I said, start with a free account, because what you can start doing is saving these images to light boxes. Those are just collections that you can review later. You can use for inspiration, share with colleagues. Say, I think this is what it should look like. What about this? I think having a great image is a great way to get inspired for that blog post. You could do that all. Shutterstock recently partnered with Facebook. You've probably seen the Shutterstock images on its ad tool, its ad creation tool. These are free to advertising customers. It's a great resource for local businesses that want really slick professional ads. You can use these tools too. Try the Shutterstock iPad app. It's Webby award-winning, gorgeous. And then if you decide to buy, all I ask is you use our offer code triangulation and the number 9. All one word. 9 because we're in the month of September, the 9th month. And you will get 30% off whatever you buy, which is a great deal. Almost a third off if you use the offer code Triangulation9, Shutterstock.com. Truly a great place to get your imagery. So tell me about this. It's called Tim's Vermeer. Yeah, before we get to that, you seem to have a love for machines, for beautiful machinery. Pinball games, computers. You have a Clover coffee maker?
Yes, I do.
One of the few private individuals, maybe the only private individual. Clover is that thing that the guy at Starbucks, Howard, saw and said, I'm not letting that stay in business. It could put Starbucks out of business. He bought the company and said, and no one else can get another one. Did you get your Clover before that? Or did you talk Howard
afterwards?
Into it?
We got it from a dealer who said, hey,
this, I have one this, in stock.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to be able to sell these. Wow. We can't get spare parts for it, so we have to hack on it to keep it working.
You need a 3D printer, titanium 3D one. Printer. Yeah, print parts for your Clover. So I get the sense that you like, that you see a beauty in perfect machinery and things that work beautifully. You talk about high quality audio. That's the same thing, right? Are you one of those audiophiles with vacuum tubes and, you know, Macintosh amps and sand tables for your turntable?
Yes, I have Martin Logan electrostatic speakers with Acoustat vacuum tube amps.
Oh, man.
It's nice sound.
And what do you use for the source?
Just a good CD
vinyl?
Player.
CD?
Yeah, you know, vinyl is overrated. I mean, there's some good things about it, but when you talk about pinch distortion, when that needle gets toward the center of the record...
Yeah.
It's not good.
I've never understood this. Now, I'm excited by what Neil Young's doing with Pono to do these 96-bit, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Higher quality digitization.
Yeah, that's neat.
I think that there's some hope there. You know, if you're recording it that way, let's hear it that way. Mm-hmm. But I agree.
It's marginally better. I mean, CD audio, 16-bit, 44 kilohertz, it's not bad. It's hard. In the early days of mastering CDs, they made a lot of mistakes, and it got a bad reputation. It took them a while to learn how to avoid that. It's not bad.
I remember some very bad CDs in the early days. You could hear the hiss from the record player.
Yeah, or you could hear in cymbals, especially sort of soft passages with cymbals, you heard crunchiness.
Yeah.
That was typical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess a Vermeer is also in some ways a perfect machine. At least it's a perfect creation.
Yeah, you know, Vermeer painted about 350 years ago in Holland, part of the Dutch Golden Age of painting, where the painters were trying to emulate reality. They wanted it to mm-hmm. be like you were looking through a window.
He painted the girl with the pearl earring.
Yeah, everybody's his most famous one.
That painting. So just so people can get an image in their head of what we're talking about.
And, you know, about 1839, when photography was invented, long after the Vermeer was dead and gone, people started to say, hey, you know, these photographs kind of look like Vermeers. That's weird. And there is something photographic. You know, when you look at advertising art today, you can usually tell if somebody started with a photograph to make their artwork. There's got a look to it. Or a little kid comes in with a picture of a cartoon character, a superhero. He says, look what I drew. And it's obviously traced, right? And you go, did you lay it over the top of the comic book? Oh, yes, I did. How did you know?
He invented it.
And so there's that look that we can kind of pick up. Well, I was looking at one of Vermeer's pictures called The Music Lesson.
Beautiful painting.
And it spoke to me. It said, I am a photograph. But there were no cameras back then. So there's been a lot of speculation about how painters could have gotten the shapes right and the perspective right by tracing a projection. You
know, right.
You can set up a simple lens, and it projects onto a flat surface. And, of course, you can go in and trace that. But I suspected that Vermeer was tracing not only the shapes but the colors.
Because they're so accurate.
Yes. And it turns out the human eye is incapable of seeing what Vermeer painted. And here's the way that works. There's a white wall in the back of his painting.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at a white wall, our brain and our retinas tend to interpret it as a solid color, even though it's infinite shades.
Yeah.
And it's happening right in our retina. There's image processing going on inside our retina.
It's actually in the eye.
Yeah, and it's this local contrast enhancement that's going on that helps us see into shadows. So evolutionarily, it helped us avoid prey, avoid predators, and see prey.
Right.
It's a motion detector. It's a motion detector also, but it's also just trying to eliminate the effect of shadows.
Right.
Well, these walls that Vermeer painted had accurate shadows,
and they shouldn't.
They shouldn't. You can't see them. His contemporaries would make a lame attempt at putting a shadow on, but Vermeer nailed it just the way a video camera sees it. And that's what got me going. And I go, there must have been a machine he could have used to do that. It's the only explanation.
Now, and where is this painting?
It's hanging in Buckingham Palace. The Queen of England owns it. And you can only get in to see it.
Have you seen it?
Yes. A few weeks a year you can get in and see it. And when I started looking at these Vermeers in person, you know, not in reproduction.
Because we're showing an image of a 300-pixel image from the internet. It doesn't do it justice.
No, it's gone through a process at that point.
Yeah.
That image you're looking at
JPEG'd like hell.
Was probably taken from like a medium format film image.
Right.
And by that time, it's gone. But if you look at that back wall,
you can see something going on there.
Yeah, the double shadow behind that mirror and behind that harpsichord. And if you look, the brightest part of the wall is right up next to the window there. The darkest part of the wall is down behind the gentleman, clear to the right.
Right.
And the ratio of light there, it's almost pure black and almost pure white. But it reads to us, if we were in that room, it would read to us as all beige.
Right.
And that's what you would paint. And if you can't paint it, you can't see it. So,
is it possible Vermeer trained his eye somehow to...
You can't.
You can't?
You can't.
You physically can't.
The retina is built the way the retina is built, and it can't see that.
So this is a little bit of a mystery.
It is a big mystery. And
so when did you first observe this?
I go to this trade show every year in Amsterdam, the IBC show. It's a big broadcasting show. And I was at the museum, the Rijksmuseum, where they have some Vermeers. And I was looking at the Vermeers, and later, after looking at them, I go, I think I see how he did it.
No.
I think I see how he did it. And so I went home.
Knowing what you do about optics, about light, I mean,
well, it's actually more what I know about electronics.
Really?
There is an electronic circuit called a comparator. It's a very simple circuit. You have two signals coming in into this little black box, and the comparator will tell you which one is higher than the other, right? Very simple device. And I reasoned that Vermeer had a very simple
analog comparator. It has to be analog. We're talking the 16th,
it's all analog.
17th century.
Yep. Yeah. So I went home and I did this experiment on my kitchen table where I propped up a photograph and I put a panel down flat on the table to paint on, and I set up this mirror at a 45-degree angle, tiny mirror on a stick. So I'm looking down in the mirror, and in the reflection in the mirror, I see the photograph. If I look off the edge of the mirror, I see my panel down on the table. I took some paint, and I put it on the panel. And now, right at the edge of the mirror, I can compare those two colors very accurately. Oh, wait, that is way too bright. Mix in some black.
Wow.
Okay? Once you've got it mixed and it's the proper color, the edge of the mirror goes away. So if it's too bright, you can see the edge of the mirror. If it's too dark, you can see the edge of the mirror. If it's exactly right, you can't see the edge of the mirror. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. It is not subjective at all. It's objective. You are a photo sensor.
It's mechanical. Here's an image of Tim doing this from a photograph. This is from the movie Tim's Vermeer.
Yeah, this is that first test I did. My daughter walked by with her digital camera and took a picture of it. So that picture vertically there.
So the mirror is attached to your glasses.
No.
Oh, you're looking through it.
The mirror is glued to a mic stand.
I see.
And I'm looking down into it. And you see there that on the table that I've made an exact copy of that photograph. This is the very first oil painting I have ever done.
You're not an artist. You're not a painter.
I'm not an artist. I've never painted in my life.
That's quite amazing.
And it works so well, I go, okay, I'm on to something here. So I started Googling. I figure somebody in the world has figured this out. So I Googled for a day. I Googled for a week. I Googled for weeks. I Googled in other languages, German, Dutch, Italian, Latin, you know, looking for speculum. I'm looking for Spiegel. I'm looking for Kunst. I'm looking for all these words that relate to artists and mirrors. And I found a lot of stuff. But not that.
You'd think if this technique were widely used in Renaissance painting that it would be known. How was he keeping it a secret?
That is one of the best arguments against this theory. But they had guilds.
Right.
Like the Freemasons would not teach laymen how to lay out the first course of bricks.
We've lost a lot of techniques.
Yeah,
because of this.
Because of the secrecy. Yeah, so they would have been keeping it all secret. That is the explanation.
Were there others of Vermeer's contemporaries who might have used this technique if you look at their paintings?
Now that I've been doing the research on it, I think I see this idea traveling through time and across Europe.
So how did you tell the world about this?
Well, after I did that experiment on my kitchen table,
which is pretty impressive. That's a good picture.
Yeah. I surprised myself and I said, this works way too well.
Yeah.
And it's simple, you know, it's elegant.
It's mechanical. You can't go wrong.
There's nothing to it. So I got a strange email from my friend Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller, who I've known for
Penn was
to 30
also
years.
A video toaster fanatic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Penn.
Is that how you got to know him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Way back when. And Penn wrote me this letter, strange, desperate-sounding letter, email. He said, I have been spending all my time with my toddlers and at work, and I am in need of an adult conversation.
I know the feeling.
Would you please come over and talk to me?
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, it's the weirdest email I ever got from him. So I said, sure, I'll come over. And we sat down at one of these Brazilian steak places where they pile the meat on. And Penn said, I do not want to hear anything about show business. I do not want to talk about politics. I do not want to talk about anything that could involve work, okay?
What do you got?
And I said, Well, have you heard of Vermeer?
I said, what do you know about Vermeer? He said, the painter? I said, yeah. He said, well, I went to his big show back in New York many years ago, and, you know, he paints, you know, photographic photorealism. I said, yeah, I think I figured out how he did it. And he said, what? And I explained it to him, and then I realized I had it on my belt. I had a camcorder, and I had a video clip there where I'd looked down through the mirror.
Oh, neat. So you could actually
show
see
him.
It.
And he says, I get this. I totally get how this works. This
sure, is, he's a magician. He's a mechanical genius.
Very similar to a magic trick.
It's how they do these disappearing things.
It's called mirror masking in magic.
Yeah.
And so he said, I
got
totally
it immediately.
Get this.
He understands the optics.
And he said, what are you going to do with this? And I said, I'm going to try to paint something that looks like a Vermeer. And I'm going to try to put this, you know, make a YouTube video about it. And he said, that is a really stupid idea. I said, what do you mean? He said, you know, let's make a movie, a real movie about this. Let's go to L.A. tomorrow and start pitching this. And that's how it started. And it just snowballed and took on a life of its own. That happened in February of 2009. And we didn't think it would take too long. But we just finished the movie just 2 weeks ago.
You actually said, I'm going to paint the music lesson.
Yeah. So what I had to do was I had to... in Lightwave 3D, I made an exact 3D model of that room and all the furniture and all the architectural features of the room, reconstructed
the room.
You
didn't start from Vermeer's painting.
No.
Holy
cow. I made the 3D model.
You made what he was painting from.
So once I had the 3D models, then I used rapid prototyping and CNC, computer-controlled milling machines and lathes to make all that furniture. I built a full-size replica of his studio with the harpsichord, the viola da gamba, the Turkish rug, everything. Everything was in there. And then I set up the machine the way I thought he must have used it. Not looking at his painting anymore. I'm now looking through the apparatus and trying to paint. And there were some false starts. It didn't work exactly right the first time. And it took me about 7 months to paint it. And when I was finished, it was...
Did it look like it?
It was the same. It was the same
Variety
picture.
Wrote yesterday, Peter DeBruck, their senior film critic, so entertaining that audiences hardly even realize how incendiary it is. Tim's Vermeer stirs up a flurry of scandal in the hallowed realm of art history. Obsessive inventor Tim Jennison has a hunch the only explanation for the photorealistic quality evident in the work of 17th century Dutch painter Johannes Vermeer is that he cheated using lenses or some other technological apparatus to achieve such remarkable detail. Jennison devises a 5-year science experiment to test his theory, emerging with an uncanny crowd pleaser, the secret weapon in Sony Pictures Classics' fall arsenal that plays like the ultimate episode of MythBusters. People are actually talking Academy Award for Best Documentary. How exciting!
Very
so
exciting.
Teller is involved too, right?
Teller directed, Penn produced,
and Penn narrates.
Penn narrates, yeah, and he appears on film. Yeah,
I can't wait to see this. So. They showed it at Telluride. I think they're still showing it. What did they? It's going to be at Toronto. It'll be at the New York Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And did they have Sony's distributing it? Is there a theatrical date?
Before the end of the year. They want to get it out before the end of the year in New York and L.A., I guess, because of the Academy rules they need to have.
Right.
Yep.
Because you want to be eligible because everybody's talking Oscar for this. David Hockney, the famous painter who did a lot of photos in his artwork is in it. What is the art world? What does the real art world have to say about this?
We don't know.
They're going to flip their lids.
You know, it's been totally under wraps until 4 days ago. It's been total secret. Nobody knew about this film. So we suspect that some of them will maybe change their minds, but others are so set in their ways.
Hockney kind of intimated that this was possibly what
Hockney
was going on.
Hockney wrote a book called Secret Knowledge 12 years ago. Where he said something changed in art. About 1500s, 1600s, something changed radically. And I think it was caused by optics. Now, he didn't know my trick.
But he thought they were tracing. You know, he thought they were just getting the shapes and the perspective right. And nobody had really suspected there's a way to trace the colors.
But he knew, because he's an artist, he could look at it and he said something. Yeah. There's a switch that got flipped. Yeah. And it's interesting because he realized that, but it took you to come along and say, I think I know how they did it.
Mm-hmm. So early in the film, before I started painting or anything, we went to visit Hockney in England, and I ran the idea past him. I showed him my first experiment, and I said, do you think this is going to work? And he said, I absolutely think it would work. And I said, do you think that they were doing this in the Golden Age? And he says, absolutely, I believe they're doing the Golden Age.
You know, more almost than the wall, though I can see why the wall is convincing. I look at the tapestry here and the detail in that, and that looks like a photo.
Yeah.
That is remarkable.
You're looking at Vermeer's picture there.
Yes, this isn't, I should say, this is not a Janison. Right. This is a Vermeer.
Yeah.
When you were painting that, I mean, what is your experience of painting it? It's all mechanical for you, right?
Yeah, it's a Zen thing. You're a machine.
Yeah.
All those little dots on that carpet are a different color. And the mirror tells you exactly what color it needs to be. And all you have to do is just sort of dab in the different colors until you've got the right
one. And there it is.
Yep.
How close? You must have been highly zoomed in to do this, right? I mean,
you're
highly magnified. If you're seeing every dot in that.
Not really magnified. It's the picture is 25 by 29 inches. Mm-hmm. It's laying flat on a table, and I'm about 8 inches above the surface of it. So that's the kind of magnification I'm seeing.
And you're not doing any optical magnification. You're actually looking directly.
Directly at the canvas.
And what kind of brush were you using? It must have been a very fine.
I used a lot of different brushes, but they were all sable brushes.
Very fine sable points. Yeah.
And they're generally used for watercolor.
Right.
But that's what worked.
And this is oils that you were using?
Yeah. I had to make the paint. Because I wanted to use only
authentic
paints that he had.
Pigments.
We know exactly which pigments he was using because of the scientific analysis.
Right.
And
so you were grinding lead?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
And mercury.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Very, very nasty
dangerous
stuff. Yeah.
And how long, 5 years this took? How long did this take?
When I actually got the room completed and started painting, it took about 7 months.
So the light wave thing was the first step. Getting it all modeled out.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get it modeled so precisely? I mean, that's a challenge in itself.
In Lightwave, you can do this. You can put an image in the background, and you can wipe back and forth, and you can overlay lines on it. And then you make certain assumptions. You make assumptions that the walls are 90 degrees to each other.
Right.
And
it'll add volume as
yeah,
needed.
And so by using those basic assumptions, you make a three-dimensional model of the room.
You were working from must have been a very high-quality reproduction.
The reproductions were all terrible.
The one I'm looking at, which is the best I could find, is on iBiblio, and this is actually a special site that they have for art. And you zoom in on it and you see all the JPEG artifacting.
Yeah, yeah. If you zoom, pan down now to that harpsichord and the lower flap right there, the lower flap is just a mishmash of stuff.
Yeah.
But when I saw the actual Vermeer in Buckingham Palace, it's sharp as a tack.
Yeah.
Everything is there.
So where did you get your copy? Did you go in and take a picture?
No, I didn't have a copy. However, that harpsichord. They still exist in museums. It was a Flemish company called Ruckers, and those decorations on there were block printed paper, and the paper is still on those instruments. And so I had this guy in Edinburgh make me those papers so that I could construct that instrument to look exactly like that. We know exactly what Vermeer was seeing because it still exists.
Just slightly obsessive.
You think? You know, they have...
What do your family think about this?
They have medications for this, but they wouldn't give me any until the film was finished.
No. I'm sure Penn's going, no, paint more.
My family couldn't have been nicer about it. My daughter posed.
It's so cute. And, she was the girl?
Yeah, and she had to have her head in a clamp for hours and hours and hours to hold her head still.
Holy cow. Well, everybody's raving about the L.A. Times, probably the biggest rave. In fact, the L.A. Times basically says that you're going to set the art world on its ear with this. Both inspired and insane. he says.
No, no.
I am dying to see it. I cannot wait till it comes out. And I think a lot of people agree from the reviews that I've read that as much as what you're doing is interesting, if it weren't for it's Tim Jennison and how much they loved you and were taken by your obsession, that's really what makes the movie.
Yeah, the movie ended up being about
about
my mental illness more than Vermeer. Yeah.
Although I just wonder what the art world's going to say, because in effect you're saying that Vermeer is not an artist, that he's a copyist.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think he was a very talented nerd.
He did compose the image, right? He put the image together.
And he was trying to make a perfect image. He was trying to make a beautiful image.
As much an artist as a photographer today is an artist.
And you know, a better analogy might be what we do in motion pictures today.
Right.
We try to we use everything we got to make a great-looking image on that screen. Whether it's computer generated or whatever, we'll use any technology, any skill we can to make a picture, and that's what they were doing back then. You know, it's the same thing.
Well, Tim, I'm thrilled that we could talk to you. I think we got an exclusive on the success of Tim's Vermeer. I can't wait to see the movie, and I again thank you for what has been a long journey for you, a 30-year journey to make the TriCaster. How much are you involved in today's TriCaster?
As little as possible.
You're busy painting. A whole career as a painter ahead of you.
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, I did a lot of the code and a lot of the design, and today we have the best team on the planet.
You do. And, I will tell you that.
And Andrew Cross, especially, who is a super genius. And
it's nice to have somebody to run the business, and you can just enjoy what you're making.
The weird thing about Andrew Cross, he's an engineer who will tell you how long something's going to take, and it will be right.
That's unheard of.
It is unheard
of.
That
doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Well, we're gonna get in just a bit. Go over. Don's going to show us, I don't know, something new, something different, something exciting. I don't know. I wouldn't sign an NDA, so I have not been informed.
It's top secret.
It's top secret. Is this the first time it's been shown anywhere?
Yes.
All right, we're gonna see something brand new. Tim, thank you so much for making our day here. I'm thrilled to have met you.
Thanks for inviting me. This has been fun.
A real honor. And again, thank you for making what we do possible, because I don't think there's any other hardware that could do what we do day in, day out. I know the TriCaster wasn't designed for 24/7 operation, but we're running a live TV station on a TriCaster.
It's absolutely amazing what you're doing here.
It's so exciting.
It's inspiring.
Thank you. Well, I'm much more inspired by what you're doing, so thank you. Tim Jennison, everybody. Newtech.com. We're going to see their stuff in just a bit. I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of Triangulation. We do this show Wednesday afternoons, 3:30 Pacific, 6:30 Eastern Time, 22:30 UTC. If you want to tune in and watch live, I really appreciate the chat room. They give me lots of good leads, lots of great questions. That's why we call it Triangulation. It's me, the guest, and you. So please be here for our live show. But if you can't watch live, audio and video on demand, always after the fact, available at twit.tv/TRI. We also put it on YouTube, youtube.com/triangulation. And, of course, you can always subscribe. That's the best thing. That way you won't miss an episode. iTunes, Dogcatcher, Instacast, Pocketcast, whatever you use, make sure you subscribe to Triangulation. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next Wednesday on Triangulation.